Thank you for listening to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. How are you listening to us? Well, it could be on digital, FM, Sirius Satellite Radio, or online at npr.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart. Barack Obama addressed race and politics head-on yesterday in a speech that was part history lesson, part explanation, and part personal confessional. For those who didn't hear it or read the senator's take on his former pastor's positions on black and white America and his own experience as a member of both groups, we have some good-sized chunks of the speech coming up shortly. But it was something Senator Obama said at the end of the speech which caught our ear.
We have a choice in this country. We can accept a politics that breeds division and conflict and cynicism. We can tackle race only as spectacle, as we did in the OJ trial, or in the wake of tragedy, as we did in the aftermath of Katrina, or as fodder for the nightly news. Or, in this election, we can come together and say, not this time.
Fodder, you say, Senator? Well, we here at the NPR's Bryant Park Project take your challenge to take this beyond sound bites and talk radio blather. Let's really explore the issues at hand with Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of black popular culture at Duke University. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Allison. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great. And Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who attended Harvard Divinity School, ran a housing project in inner-city Boston. His latest book is entitled I Don't Believe in Atheists. Hey, Chris, thanks for being with us.
Not at all.
All right, the first issue up, American history and how it leads us to where we are today in terms of race relations. Let's listen to the senator.
As William Faulkner once wrote, the past isn't dead and buried. In fact, it isn't even past. We do not need to recite here the history of racial injustice in this country. But we do need to remind ourselves that so many of the disparities that exist between the African-American community and the larger American community today can be traced directly to inequalities passed on from an earlier generation that suffered under the brutal legacy of slavery and Jim Crow.
Mark, what did Obama accomplish by emphasizing history and his choice of Faulkner in particular?
Well, I think folks have, you know, short memories. And, you know, once we don't see visibly the very vicious racism that we saw in American society in the 1950s and 60s, there's a, you know, this sense of forgetting, you know, what exactly happened. And the fact that some folks have not really been dealt with in terms of quality of life issues since that point in time. I thought his reference to William Faulkner was brilliant. I mean, William Faulkner is generally recognized as one of the folks who most successfully dealt with the difficult questions of race in American history. I mean, here he is as a Southern novelist. He's writing in his novels in which he really talks about the complicated ways that black and white lives are connected and how they both needed each other and how they both really had tragic experiences because of racism. And his invocation of William Faulkner at that moment really suggests to a larger public that Barack Obama himself sees himself as potentially being the kind of person that, like Faulkner, can help the nation work through the tensions around race.
Chris, what do you think Obama accomplished by emphasizing history?
Well, the problem with Obama's talk is that he could not walk outside of that paradigm of us as a good and virtuous nation.
Because of his candidacy.
Well, because that's the national myth. And so he had to sort of walk that line from speaking about gross injustices that were perpetuated and continue to be perpetuated. I mean, remember that we are a resegregated society, that, what is it, 1 in 9 in every adult black males are in prison, that pockets of the inner city are actually worse in terms of crumbling infrastructure, failing schools, you know, redlining. You know, we've made terrible reverses, certainly on the economic level for, you know, large numbers of African Americans. And that's something that Jeremiah Wright was getting up and acknowledging. But he can't go that far. I mean, there were limitations caused by the political campaign. I mean, you saw it, for instance, in his defense of Israel, you know, despite the humanitarian crisis and brutal violence that's being unleashed on the Palestinians in Gaza. So he was walking a very fine line, and I think that especially for those of us, you know, I spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times and the developing world, and for those of us that have been on the receiving end of American repression, whether that is in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Certainly, look at the war in Iraq. I covered the Contra war in Nicaragua. You know, we, like all imperial powers, deal much more in moral ambiguity, and much of what is done is in our name.
So you didn't think he went far enough for
well,
your
could,
case?
He could limited go far because enough. He can't, you know, he has to appeal to that mythic vision that we carry about ourselves.
Well, because he's running for president. I do want to get to something that you just mentioned there, Chris. One of the reasons Obama had to give this speech, obviously the increased scrutiny on Reverend Jeremiah Wright, former longtime pastor in Obama's church. Obama spoke about how we discuss race in this country and the way we discuss it, why it might not be helpful. Let's play that clip.
The fact that so many people are surprised to hear that anger in some of Reverend Wright's sermons simply reminds us of the old truism that the most segregated hour of American life occurs on Sunday morning. That anger is not always productive. Indeed, all too often, it distracts attention from solving real problems. It keeps us from squarely facing our own complicity within the African American community in our own condition. But the anger is real. It is powerful. And to simply wish it away, to condemn it without understanding its roots, only serves to widen the chasm of misunderstanding that exists between the races.
Mark, have you seen what the senator described? People discussing race in their own little pockets and only being actually truthful in their own little pockets?
I think even on a campus like Duke University, you know, folks are not or rarely completely honest about the issue of race. And I think, you know, what Reverend Wright represents in a certain kind of way, I mean, there's a historical narrative, as Senator Obama suggests, where black folks are very critical of race and white supremacy and the realities of how these things are lived, but very rarely do whites hear those kind of critiques put back at themselves. They may respond to critiques about the historical legacy of slavery, but in terms of why someone young and black or even older black would still be angry at white America in 2008, most white folks very rarely hear those critiques. And when they do finally hear them, it is amongst the spectacle, a soundbite from someone like a Jeremiah Wright. And I think, you know, Obama's right. I mean, we really do have to find ways to work through and have this conversation, a difficult conversation. And I think Chris is dead on. I mean, it has to be connected to a broader sense of how the United States is viewed globally and how, you know, race as it's lived here in the United States also factors in terms of how, you know, imperialism functions in the larger globe.
Chris, you spent a lot of time in an economically disadvantaged predominantly black neighborhood outside of Boston. Did you see what Senator Obama described?
Yes. I mean, I think you have to live in the ghetto to understand how institutional repression works, how banks, the police, probation officers, schools work to keep poor people poor. It's very, very hard to leave the ghetto because you have everything against you, including the fact that your chances of getting picked up and tossed in prison are extremely high. For me, reading through, let's concede his rhetorical excesses, but I think reading through everything I've seen Reverend Wright say, in fact, it's true. He's speaking a kind of truth, which, frankly, having come out of divinity school, is the role of a minister, that makes especially white America very uncomfortable. Authentic religion is supposed to make you uncomfortable. That's what the prophets did. That rage is, as Obama acknowledged, is real. But not only is it real, I think it's justified. And I think and that's what Wright was getting at. And that's where finally Obama couldn't go.
Obama did spend a good deal of time discussing white anger as well. This clip's a little bit long, but I think we need the full time to really digest the point. So let's play this.
Most working and middle class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game, in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told an African American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time. Like the anger within the black community, these resentments aren't always expressed in polite company, but they have helped shape the political landscape for at least a generation. And yet to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding.
Mark, let me go to you first. White anger, is it something that has any resonance in black popular culture in any of the courses you teach?
I think, you know, early on in his career, someone like Eminem was a good example of that. You know, what you had early in his career, his first couple of albums, was an example of really the disaffected white guy who's trying to work through the fact that he's struggling economically, trying to deal with a very different racial landscape in a city like Detroit or outside of Detroit. And I think very often, at least in the classroom, it's very difficult to get young black kids to wrap their heads around the fact that there are, in fact, white folks who do not have the same kind of access to white privilege that we presume all white folks do. And I think this is really where, you know, where Obama really can't go where he needs to go. It's the kind of politics that, you know, in a worst-case scenario gets you killed. I mean, what Martin Luther King did very successfully is that he was able to take a message that resonated amongst both poor white and poor black to see that there's a larger system that's disaffecting and exploiting all of them. The proverbial conversation between, you know, the projects, the PJs, and the trailer park. And I think, you know, that's when you have a moment of real social change. I think Obama's campaign down the road has the capacity to do that, but not without having this very honest conversation about race that acknowledges the ways in which, particularly poor white folks, you know, don't quite see, you know, who the figures are that are kind of forcing them in the positions that they are, and are sort of told that, you know, via someone like Geraldine Ferraro, that, you know, it's affirmative action and black privilege that's allowing them to be disaffected the way they are and outside of the mainstream the way that they are. And that's a very honest conversation that is not going to make the street very comfortable, and by that I mean Wall Street. It is not going to make, you know, corporate America very comfortable, because then they get, you know, refigured in this conversation as targets, you know, amongst poor people who are being exploited and don't have access to privilege and economic you know, safety.
And Chris, do you think folks who have white anger about their position and people who have black anger about their position perhaps have more in common than they realize?
Well, of course they do. They come from the same socioeconomic condition. I mean, there's been a kind of Weimarization of the American working class through the outsourcing of jobs. I mean, the situation in former manufacturing centers, and much of my own family comes from mill towns in Maine, is really desperate. I mean, the downtowns of these towns are boarded up wrecks. Good jobs are never coming back. This has been accompanied by a slashing of state and federal assistance. You know, we've seen the rise of an American oligarchy, with the top 1% controlling more wealth than the bottom 90% combined.
So why don't those two groups understand each other then?
Because, as Freud said, it's the narcissism of minor difference. What happens is the lower you sink on the ladder, the more racism becomes a factor. Because what's separating from you as a poor white from a poor black, the only thing that you can try and use to elevate yourself above others suddenly becomes ethnic or racial. Look, the war against immigrants that is being driven by right-wing forces in this country is a good example of that. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. The war in Yugoslavia was not caused by religion or ancient ethnic hatreds. It was caused by the economic meltdown of Yugoslavia. And here we stand on the cusp of severe economic dislocation. I think those kinds of conditions, and I think history bears me out, exacerbates racism at a time when race or ethnic groups that turn on each other are in fact all being plunged into a kind of despair and impoverishment. And that, of course, is the tragedy, because rather than looking at globalization, at the forces, NAFTA, the WTO, the Taft-Hartley Act, which have made, you know, organizing unions virtually impossible, instead of confronting these issues, they play that emotive and emotional race card,
yeah.
or we see it with immigrants, that ethnic card.
Well, we could go on with this conversation, but we're coming up on a hard break. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of Black popular culture at Duke University, and Chris Hedges is the author of the book, I Don't Believe in Atheists. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.